Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough, and today we're going to focus on stories related to homelessness, including the little we know about something called Operation Rio Grande, as well as Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams' undercover visit to a homeless shelter, and the role that opioid addiction is playing in the neighborhood that surrounds the downtown shelter. And then a little bit later on in the program, we'll also look at concerns over how Utah elected officials use social media. We'll check in on the Republican primary in the special congressional election and more. And joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Taylor Anderson is here. Good morning, Taylor.
Morning, Roger.
Government reporter Courtney Tanner is also here with us. Welcome and good morning.
Good morning.
Also, editorial writer and columnist George Pyle joins us. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And listeners, we invite you to join this conversation during this Friday morning news wrap-up with your questions and comments at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. A number of stories related to homelessness this week, and I think I'd like to start with Taylor Anderson, where we are currently in the new but secret plan to deal with crime that is plaguing the blocks around the shelter downtown. This is a city, county, state initiative called Operation Rio Grande, apparently. What do we know about this?
So for years, the sheriff's office for Salt Lake County has said that they don't have enough jail beds. And that came to a head this week because the jail's commander, Pam Lofgren, came to the county council saying that as part of Operation Rio Grande, she was asking for some funding because they had identified open beds down in Utah County. They lost a federal contract, and so they had 128 extra beds that Salt Lake County could send prisoners who were there, or inmates who were there for you know, moderate periods of time, and they could pay them to house these inmates and free up beds for whatever's about to happen. We don't know exactly what the operation is going to be, but apparently it involves jail beds, needing jail space.
Well, obviously that suggests that there will be arrests of people. And so there have been some hiccups, though, when it comes to this bed situation, because yesterday you learned that actually the bed space that had been freed up actually isn't there.
Yeah, it sounds like it's been a hectic week of negotiations between different state agencies, the governor's office, the county, and the city's also involved in these talks. Nobody's, you know, really releasing these too publicly, but we found out that just hours after Pam Lofgren got approved by the Salt Lake County Council to fund at $72 per day per inmate these 128 beds in Utah County, she said that she got a text from Roland Cook, who oversees the prisons. He said that deal is not going to go through. That was just 6 hours after she just got the approval to go ahead from the Salt Lake County Council. And so things were, you know, apparently negotiations were happening just by the hour. Things were changing yesterday. Thursday was when it all kind of fell into place, and they finally have a plan going forward.
Do they, I guess the question that I have is, will there be enough space to house the people, well, to jail, I guess, the people that this operation that we don't know a lot about is expected to nab? I guess we don't really know the answer to that question.
The legislature in their past session agreed to split the cost with Salt Lake County to free up 300 beds. So there has been this funding, and all these negotiations that took place this week were revolving around that number still. So we don't know a lot about what, you know, law enforcement is going to do, when they're going to do it, who they're going to target, but we do know that they were looking for 300 extra beds, and now they have them.
So you can imagine that this one of the targets would be people involved in the drug trade. What we don't know maybe is whether it goes beyond that.
Right. I mean, because it's called Operation Rio Grande, so dubbed by the Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, it's clearly revolving around Rio Grande. That's the neighborhood by the homeless shelter. There's, you know, open air drug dealing, drug using. We don't know, again, you know, who their primary targets are of this. We just know that there's a lot of, you know, lawlessness in the area, and now they have and the jails are involved. So,
and again, this is part of this state, city, county plan that came out of meetings that they had a few weeks back. A previous operation that was city and county led called Operation Diversion included efforts to, well, to divert people into treatment. It was essentially offering them, you know, saying we're going to either arrest you or you're going to choose to go into treatment. Which of those do you choose? And do we know if there will be a component of that? I guess you probably don't because you still don't know the details.
We don't know. I do know that on a weekly basis in the county, my beat is the county government, and they talk about this constantly that they do not have enough funding for treatment for the need that's out there. So they did apply. They tried to get more state funding through the $6 million grant that the legislature had approved. They didn't get the greater portion of the share that they were hoping to get, which would have funded more treatment. So I know that money is not available. There are, you know, even as part of this, they almost lost treatment beds. It's not going to happen now. That's the nature of this. It was off the table. There's a program through the Salt Lake County Jail where there's drug treatment. Almost was on the chopping block. It's not anymore. So we know that they didn't lose any, hopefully, but we don't know that they've, you know, identified any extra funding as part of this. It could have happened, but we don't know.
Well, you know, you've suggested that the kind of crime aspect of this operation. If we look at homelessness, there's crime, and then there's also addiction being a part of this. Economics is another part of this. I'm wondering if. You know, we've got people on the street now, and we've got people who are headed that direction. Jail beds is going to be part of this plan, but do we know if that's sort of phase one of multiple phases that will include treatment? Again, this is me speculating. You don't know the answer to that.
We don't know. We know that there's a lot of attention on the issue, that it clearly involves homelessness because this is the area immediately surrounding the road home. It's a large homeless shelter downtown that, you know, they say that the county officials, state officials say that these homeless, these vulnerable people are being preyed upon by drug dealers and that's making efforts to improve services to homeless residents more difficult and they're not getting the services that they need. So it's in the background of this. We don't know, again, if this, you know, impending law enforcement action is targeting homeless. You know, I don't think that's part of what the conversations that have been happening for the last 3 years are about.
The fact that it's a pending law enforcement action, though, it makes me wonder if additional money has been needed to make this operation happen. If it's sort of ongoing law enforcement efforts, then it might be within, you know, part of the budget that they're actually already working with.
I think so. That nobody's come out and said, but again, these are pretty private talks. They're secretive talks. For a minute, it looked like Salt Lake County was going to add an extra, you know, $20 per day for those beds down in Utah County. Then they were paying other jails to house their inmates, but you know, that deal fell off the table. So that was the only extra funding that has been released publicly.
Well, I want to bring George Pyle, opinion writer for the Tribune, in on this. And George, for years we've heard that you know, the majority of people who are experiencing homelessness are those who are experiencing short-term homelessness. These are people who have something catastrophic happen and then maybe don't have a support network. And then they're on the street for a short while with the assistance of the various homeless service providers, some very heroic workers doing a tough job. Get them out of that and move them beyond homelessness. But the problems that are down in this district, the Rio Grande district behind that depot, feels like something different. And I guess what I'm wondering is if the face of homelessness in our city is itself changing, if we're seeing more and more of the so-called chronic homeless that the state a few years back was supposedly trying to eliminate altogether.
Yeah, that's what I teased them about a couple of years ago. They said, we've eliminated homelessness in Salt Lake County, and we loved it so much we're going to go do it again. And part of it is definitions. Bureaucracies and grant agencies and everybody have definitions of different kinds of homelessness. And they said they had eliminated chronic homelessness, which meant that you didn't have people who were homeless for like a year in a row or twice in 3 years or something like that was the definition. And we got to the point where we had little to none of that. We had a lot more, as you say, temporary people who their roommate moved out, their husband left them, they couldn't make the rent, they were living in their car, they would go to the road home, they would stay there for a little bit, or they would put them in housing and maybe they'd stay there, maybe they wouldn't, but at least somebody was doing something and they would move along. There have always been within that, a kind of an unfortunate core of people who were addicts, people who are mentally ill. I mean, the people you see downtown all the time at the train station, yelling at God, talking to themselves. I mean, there aren't that many of those, but they were the hardcore. They were the ones who were you couldn't just get them a job, clean them up and get them a job. They needed serious help. With the opioid epidemic,
right,
and with the fact that after the opioids are not available or become too expensive, you move to heroin, that is, I think, to a large degree, what has caused a real explosion of campers, of criminals, of drug dealers, of people shooting up in broad daylight right in front of the cops. And so now they're looking at this, and Taylor's done a good job of exposing all the dots, and I think it's fair of us to try and connect them. Apparently, they're planning on arresting a whole lot of people.
And they're being very secretive about it. I mean, Taylor, you saw a comment from Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams and others, and essentially they're holding off saying anything in for fear of what, tipping their hand, kind of?
Essentially, yeah. They say it's a law enforcement action. They say that lives could be at stake, and that's why they have to be so secretive.
Okay. You mentioned the opioid addiction, George Pyle, and it's something that Salt Lake Tribune reporter Christopher Smart took a deep look at. In a paper, in some articles that he wrote, one article in particular that he wrote, profiles of people struggling with this opioid addiction, kind of a major culprit. And one of the people that he highlighted in his reporting is a young mother of three who has essentially been separated from her children by her addiction. And George, there can be a kind of tendency to demonize addicts, but the story by Christopher Smart kind of brings home the idea that that at least, you know, for this person and probably for a great many others, this isn't a lifestyle choice at all. This is something they can't escape.
The image of the addict or the homeless addict has often been somebody who looks like me but hasn't had a bath for a month and is wandering around and panhandling and talking to himself.
Are you saying this because you're bearded? Sorry, just out of curiosity.
Yeah, no, old bearded guy who just probably could use a visit to a barber. And you know, you have a long, dirty raincoat on or something, and you wander around the street bothering people. And more it is, as Chris highlighted, people who were prescribed opioids because they hurt their back or they had surgery or something like that. And this is wonderful stuff. This will keep away the pain. Well, before you know it, you're hooked. And the doctor won't give it to you anymore. It becomes too expensive. Your insurance won't cover it. You go out onto the street looking for it. You move from prescription pills that are on the black market to heroin. You get really hooked on that. And then it becomes a criminal matter. Then it becomes things like Operation Rio Grande, Operation Diversion, you know, like Operation Barbarossa or Overlord or something like that. And it gives everybody this feeling of, boy, we're gonna hit the beach. We're gonna clean up this problem. And then, you know, until it comes back in a couple of weeks. You wonder, in a state run by free market Republicans, why they don't understand that supply always follows demand. And if they think they're going to do this with interdiction, if they think they're going to do this with a sweep of arresting a bunch of low-level mules, then I don't know what drugs they're taking, but that's not going to work.
This is a topic that that we're definitely not going to leave behind here, and we will come back to it in a moment. We do have to take a break. A reminder that we'd like your comments on all of this. Listeners, you can post to the KCPW Facebook page or the Salt Lake Tribune's website or call us up at 801-355-TALK. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Courtney Tanner, government reporter Taylor Anderson, and editorial writer and columnist George Pyle. Call us with your questions and comments. We're at 801-355-8255. Before we went to the break, we were discussing the secretive Operation Rio Grande, soon to be, or who knows, maybe even currently underway around the downtown homeless shelter. And we also heard a little bit on people struggling with opioid addiction in that neighborhood. I want to turn now, though, to the story of a kind of undercover investigation of conditions at the shelter. I don't know if that's the appropriate way of describing this, but Courtney Tanner, Salt Lake Tribune, government reporter, Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams, some months back, it turns out, went to get a firsthand look at the shelter But as readers, at least, we only just found out about this. Tell us what Mayor McAdams did, Courtney.
Yeah, Mayor McAdams wanted to get this kind of firsthand look. He said that's been missing throughout this whole process. And so one day he just decided to leave the county office building at 5 p.m. and walk down to the homeless district. And he, for the first night, he slept outside on the sidewalk. And then the second night, he slept inside the road home shelter.
Okay, so two nights in the shelter, 3 days kind of on the street experimenting. What was he trying to learn?
He had this big decision to make over where Salt Lake County was going to place their homeless shelter site. It ended up being in South Salt Lake. And so he just kind of wanted to see, you know, what's the current state of the shelter? What are the shortcomings? What can we fix with this new shelter? And just to inform his decision.
And he was kind of adamant that this wasn't a publicity stunt. And the Tribune actually had a hard time kind of convincing him to come forward and talk about this. Is that correct?
Yeah. So we found out about this in April. He had stayed over kind of at the end of March. And so we kind of started asking him in April, and he didn't want to talk about it. And then we finally kind of wrangled him into it and had a sit-down discussion about his stay there.
Hmm. And he described his, you know, his experience on the street, his experience in the shelter. He mentioned, you know, kind of being consumed with trying to figure out where to eat, you know, where to sleep. And that took, you know, most of his energy of the day. And of course, he was just a sort of not tourist, but somebody doing an experiment versus people who were suffering this on a long period of time. But so what were his sort of impressions, his firsthand impressions of his experience?
Yeah, so you're right. He kind of was shocked by how much of his time was consumed by worrying about where he was going to find shelter or where he was going to find food. His stay in the shelter was interesting. He kind of said, you know, I saw signs of drug use. He wouldn't go into detail on what exactly that is. But, you know, he had people tell him in the shelter, don't take off your shoes. People will steal them. Or, you know, don't go to the bathroom after dark, which kind of left him feeling nervous and afraid. And he went with another county staffer who got assigned to a bed in a different room. And so it just was kind of this overwhelming fear that people really face on an everyday basis.
Hmm. You know, Courtney, you've done some yourself. You've done some profiles on people who are homeless, who have lived in the shelter downtown. It's funny. It's hard to compare the mayor's experience to that of somebody who's homeless. But did he have the typical homeless experience?
You know, a lot of people that I talked to said, you know, he just got a glimpse. And I think that's a good way to look at this. He got just kind of a glimpse. But even he said, you know, I had my phone in my pocket. If anything happened, I could have just called my wife. I could have just left. I don't have to stay here. This isn't where I live. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of this sense that, wow, people do live in these conditions every day. This is a typical experience.
Mm-hmm. George Pyle from the Opinion Desk, I should say that McAdams got a little bit of flack, and maybe actually, Courtney, you can describe this, a little bit of flack for taking up space at the shelter, essentially, correct?
So the shelter's director, executive director, he said, you know, I understand why he did this. He just kind of hoped it didn't set off this wave of what he called homeless tourism. Right. You know, this shelter is at capacity. You know, they have 1,000 beds, and the director is like, don't take up these beds for your own experiment here.
Hmm. George, the county mayor trying to get a firsthand glimpse at how it is to utilize homeless services here in Salt Lake County, and also to think about how they might be improved in this new location. We'll get to that in a little bit. What do you think, just generally, of that effort, that experiment on the part of the county mayor?
Yeah, well, I think he was already working on this. I don't think he needed to be convinced or evangelized that this was a problem that we needed to do something about. But I mean, I understand why he would want to get down in there and without the entourage and without the press and just have a little bit of an experience for himself. And I think probably what he said he learned is that how all-consuming it can be to be on the street. I mean, there's been a lot of research on this. Buffalo News, I used to work for, won a lot of prizes for what they called the high price of being poor. When you have nothing, you spend all your day like hunter-gatherers of millions of years ago, and you have no time to make anything, create anything, get a job, get an education. any of that stuff. You're just consumed with survival day to day. And the fact that he experienced that is useful. And also, we wrote an editorial supporting what he did, mostly because there had been some comments that this was all a publicity stunt. Well, obviously, this was the opposite of a publicity stunt. He didn't tell anybody. Courtney had to drag it out of him. And Ben McAdams knows how to do a publicity stunt if he wants to. He could have walked right off the street, right into a news conference, still wearing his homeless outfit, and had a big speech and press conference about what a wonderful guy he was because he'd done this. He did none of that. He was just trying to keep it quiet and have this experience. So I think the main thing is I don't think it's fair to call it a stunt because I think he learned something from it, and he wasn't bragging about it.
Right. I want to remind our listeners that you can call us with your thoughts and questions. The number is 801-355-8255. You can also comment at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. George, I'm thinking about also House Speaker Greg Hughes opened up a kind of pop-up office downtown to get his own experience in this region or in this area, this district, the homeless, what's been termed the homeless services district or the homeless district in Salt Lake City, I mean, I don't know if you can compare going in and being the person trying to experience homelessness firsthand to that, but a lot of efforts by different officials to get a better sense of what's happening.
Well, certainly, I mean, this has been discovered. They've got their war cabinet now. They've got Spencer Cox kind of taking the lead on this. They resist the term czar, but they're trying to coordinate, get together, raise the money. And like I said earlier, it becomes sort of this military operation, which in my mind is both unfortunate and necessary. I mean, they've let it come to such a pass that action like this on almost a military scale is necessary. I mean, they've kind of walked away from Greg Hughes's crack about bringing in the National Guard, but when they're, you know, lining up hundreds of jail beds and treatment beds and all that in obvious anticipation of needing to fill them fast, then obviously they've militarized this to some degree. It's sad when you have to do that, but it looks like they have to do that.
Going back to you, Courtney, part of this, again, as you mentioned, had to do with where McAdams was going to decide to put this new shelter, a new homeless resource center. And he made a decision after this. I mean, he actually made his way to the site of the shelter in his experience on the street as while he was doing this experiment of staying on the street or in the shelter. Which of these shelters are we talking about?
So there were five different options at this time, and he had to kind of narrow it down and pick one. So there were three in West Valley and two in South Salt Lake, and he took tracks to every single one of them, visited them, you know, saw what it would be like if you didn't have a car, how you would get to these places, how you'd find services around there. And he ended up choosing one in South Salt Lake.
And that's okay. So that's how it played into his decision, was deciding, was it accessible? Could he get there? This kind of brings us back actually full circle all the way back around to Taylor Anderson. And you reported, Taylor, this week on the funding structure for these new shelters, and there are three new shelters. This week, we learned about a payment from the state of Utah to the LDS Church for a property that they own. It's actually really just around the corner here from where we are sitting. How much money are we talking about, and what is that buying?
Well, the Shelter the Homeless Board, it's a nonprofit. They've been around for about 30 years. They're now kind of in the driver's seat of these negotiations. There are various people that are working on the homelessness issue on the board of that. So they're making the decisions here. I guess they came up with they negotiated the terms of purchasing the three shelters when we do eventually in the next 2 years, you know, move to closing down the road home and then open three scattered and smaller sites. There, I guess they agreed to buy from the LDS Church, the Deseret Industries thrift store on 7th South and about 1st East for $4.46 million. The other two were a little bit cheaper. One was on High Avenue, which is near 3rd West, and the other is in South Salt Lake, which the county had already invested money in, so it was a lot cheaper. It's also vacant land.
All three of the purchase price for this one on 7th South is how much again? 4.5 million. Also, the one on High Avenue was roughly
three, maybe,
yeah, somewhere in there, and then maybe $500,000 just for the property of this other place. This is just for the property, not for the building of the shelters,
not correct? For the building and not for the architect, the fees for the architects who will design it. So they'll actually, two sites again have buildings on them. Those will be demolished. Architects are coming up with the renderings of what will eventually be these new sites. And the state also funded the fees for those architects to move forward. Mm-hmm. It's a Salt Lake City firm, I think AJC, if I've got it right. It was about around $2 million for that.
How many beds, how many people will the shelter provide shelter for?
It's
these shelters, sorry, all three of them.
700 total, 200 at the two in Salt Lake City and 300 for the single men's shelter in South Salt Lake.
Can we, just for one quick moment, okay, so there's one at 700 South between State Street and 200 East. There's one on High Avenue. This is near to what I'll forever call Dirks Field, the Smith's Ballpark. And then a third one in South Salt Lake, which is the coordinates of that?
It's 3380 South and 1000 West. It's right near the Salt Lake County Jail.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're looking at just in the build aspect, or the purchase of these lands, $8 million for 700 beds. And then, yeah, as you mentioned, there's the cost of architects, of building to be considered. We're talking about a lot more than just 700 people here in the lifespan of these locations. But actually, I'll bring George Pyle back into this. George, that would be $10,000 or more per bed in the building costs alone. And I kind of don't want to let that slide. Is that price tag reasonable?
Well, I haven't done the work to compare it to what they've done in other cities. I know they're trying to make these, they're trying to scatter the site so you don't have this concentration of all the homeless in one neighborhood. They're trying to make the buildings something that you're not afraid of just by looking at it. They're trying to make it fit into neighborhoods. They're, at the same time, they have to have a lot of security. Again, they don't want the neighborhoods that they build these buildings in to have the neighbors come and burn it down. I mean, they've been but it's part of the reason they had such a hard time finding a site is nobody wants a homeless shelter next to them. And part of the response to that has been, well, but it's going to be a really nice homeless shelter. It won't even look like a homeless shelter, we promise. So that costs money. I mean, you're not just putting up a Quonset hut. You're trying to build a nice apartment-style building that doesn't frighten the children.
Taylor, also the downtown shelter after these other shelters are come online is slated to close. I'm imagining that the people seeking shelter services there, who are actually seeking those shelter services, will move to these new locations. And I know that there's a breakdown on one being a woman's shelter, one being mixed, and one being a men's shelter. But I don't know if you can answer this. What about the people who are camped out and who rely on other services that are downtown? Will they remain where they are? Maybe that's the point, is separating these two groups, those who are seeking shelter services and those who are kind of camped out.
Right. And there are a lot of people downtown. It's clear that 700 beds, there are more than 700 people down there right now. There's I think 1,100 beds in the Roadhelm currently. So that's 400 more than they're going to have. In the background of all this, Salt Lake County, led by Mayor Ben McAdams, for the past 3 years, they've been working to try to align all these service providers to try to make this a much better system so that, there's no overlap, there's no inefficiencies. They're all working together, these service providers. I guess that's not exactly answering your question about what is going to happen to these hundreds of people, but they're thinking that the services will be much better. Also, the providers that are down there currently, St. Vincent's and the Wigan Day Center, they say they're not going anywhere. So even after these shelters are closed down, I think June 30th, 2019, and the new ones open up, they're going to stay open, they said.
Courtney, this is something that you reported on, that the fact that these places are staying there and will be now removed from the shelters.
I talked to several folks who kind of live in the area outside of the shelters, and they say, I'm not leaving this area. This is where I get food. This is where I get their medical care, right? There's the 4th Street Clinic. They said, I don't care if you move the shelters, you're not moving me, kind of thing.
Yeah. And again, those are people who are homeless downtown and aren't, they're not living in the shelter, and this is part of the purpose of the shelters isn't necessarily to permanently house people, but these are people who are, again, of a maybe a different category. Taylor, can we talk just for a brief moment about what the three locations, I'm sorry to do this, but the three locations are meant to house? Because I said women and children, or women, men, and the sort of mixed shelter site. Which site is doing what?
Right. The Desert Industries site, 7th South and 131 East, is going to house single women, only women at that shelter. The one on 275 West High Avenue is going to be a mix of men and women, and the South Salt Lake site is going to be just single men, 300 single men across from the Salt Lake County Jail.
Is there, again, Courtney, going back to your story about the fact that these service providers that aren't shelters are sticking around, has there been any push to try and move them?
You know, these new resource centers that they're building, these three new shelters, are supposed to be kind of like all-encompassing, right? They're going to have these resources for homeless individuals to use, but there's still kind of pushback from people who maybe live in Pioneer Park or who camp out who aren't going to go to these shelters anyway.
They'll still need those services whether or not they're nearby to them. They're not going to move. Taylor, what's the time frame again on the closure of the road home?
It's June 30th, 2019, and in all this, the purchasing of the closing of the properties and moving toward construction, there are now these deadlines to make sure that we're actually going to meet that, because 2 years is kind of, it's a pretty quick turnaround. We're less than 2 years now, what, 1.5 almost,
right.
And they still have to knock down these buildings and build them again. The DI, the Deseret Industries thrift store, is going to be open until the end of November. And then in that agreement to purchase that property, I think it's significant construction must begin by summer of 2018 in order to keep that contract moving forward. So,
early on, I remember hearing that there was some pushback from the shelters themselves, or from the shelter, from the road home. I guess the question I have is, do they absolutely have to close the road home shelter? Anybody know that?
I think they do, yes.
Okay. George Pyle, any further thoughts on how this is all playing out? And, you know, we're kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop when it comes to Operation Rio Grande, but in terms of, you know, concerted efforts to address homelessness in Salt Lake City.
It looks like everybody's on board all the way up and down the governmental ladder, Republicans, Democrats, state, local, political operators, policy wonks, they're all on this. They all want to get something done. They have to understand, and I think on some level they do understand, this is General Petraeus counterinsurgency. This is clear, hold, build, and it's in for the long haul, and it's not going to be solved overnight. And if anybody thinks that they're going to close this shelter and open that shelter and have a roundup and, by golly, we've solved the problem, that's not going to happen. I don't think – I mean, Ben McAdams knows that's not going to happen. I think Greg Hughes knows that's not going to happen. But there's going to have to be a continuous effort and a lot of money put into this, or it'll all be for naught.
It'll be interesting to see, you know, what the effect is both of this this short-term Operation Rio Grande that's happening. I'm sure we'll be talking about it in the coming weeks, if not next week, and then, in the longer term. But guys, for now, I think we're going to move on to other topics beyond homelessness from this past week's news. But first, let's head to our second break of the show, and we'll return in a minute. This is Behind the Headlines, the weekly news wrap-up from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. We'll be back shortly.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Taylor Anderson, Courtney Tanner, and George Pyle. Listeners, call us up with your comments and questions. The number is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And I just named everyone in the studio, but actually for the remainder of the program, we'll also have Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr with us. He joins us by phone right now. And Tommy, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning.
I want to get to some election-related stories a little bit later on, but first, a story that you covered about elected officials and how they use their social media. And the takeaway here is kind of that if you're a politician, think twice before you block someone on Facebook, right?
That's pretty much the message from the ACLU of Utah. And this is kind of a nationwide thing the ACLU has been on for a little while. So the Utah chapter sent letters to the five members of Congress from Utah, warning them against blocking anyone on Facebook or Twitter, saying that, you know, courts have ruled that there's a First Amendment protection, that you can't just, you know, block somebody who you don't like criticizing you on a social media forum. That's continuing an effort they've been doing. I think there's a lawsuit filed against the Maryland governor, the Maine governor, and other lawmakers have received similar letters from the ACLU. And again, this just goes back to, for example, Tom Taylor, who's a Democrat planning to run against Representative Mia Love, was apparently blocked, according to the ACLU, from Mia Love's Twitter account, from being able to follow her or respond to her. That ended at some point, but the ACLU points out the only real reason that you could block somebody is if they, you know, actually are threatening you or using some kind of obscene language. And the ACLU says none of these people who have blocked have actually done that.
Are there any, you know, so there's potential violation of free speech laws, any potential penalties for doing this? And you know, now that they've been sort of instructed that they might be in violation of First Amendment rights, are they going to have to unblock people? I guess that's a tough question to answer, Tommy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's any penalty. Essentially, you know, it could go to court if they file a lawsuit, and the judge would have to order them to you know, unblock somebody, but I don't know if there's any kind of penalty. This always reminds me of a little-known fact that this is one of the court rulings. Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler magazine, mails a copy of Hustler magazine to every member of Congress every month.
I remember that.
And then people have tried to block that, saying, you know, we don't want this, you know, this smut coming to our office, but because of that great part of the First Amendment says you may seek redress from Congress, they can't actually stop him from mailing it.
Well, and that's in the you know, using the mail. I'm surprised, though, that we haven't seen a discussion about the sort of social media part of this before. I mean, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, they're all part of the public dialogue, and they have been for a little bit longer than, you know, than just, you know, the past few years. So it's kind of surprising we haven't had this this issue come up before.
Yeah, but I think it's becoming more prevalent. I mean, members of Congress, most of them, Rob Bishop really doesn't tweet, but most members of Congress do use social media in some form, and it's become kind of a primary route. So, yeah, people aren't mailing things anymore. They don't go online and comment on their website. They use a Twitter account or go on Facebook and offer comments there. So this is becoming the new round, the new battle for First Amendment groups to say, you know, you have to allow this exchange of ideas even if you don't like it.
And there has been, I'm just thinking about this particular topic, there was a Representative Mia Love took a little bit of flack for not having, you know, in-person town halls and instead kind of leaning on the online platforms to engage her her constituents. Is that right?
Yeah, in fact, I mean, Courtney can talk about this. She covered an event that Mia Love held instead of a town hall, so maybe I should let Courtney.
Yeah, sure, Courtney, weigh in.
Yeah, so last week, Mia Love held what she called open office hours, and so she'd meet with groups of constituents, up to 10 people, it was usually about 4 or 5, and just kind of have a conversation with them rather than stand on stage and let a big audience kind of yell.
George Pyle, I want to bring you in on this too, from the opinion desk. The fact that there is this public space that is social media, some politicians making better use of it than others, some you know, leaning kind of heavily on it as opposed to having in-person meetings. Not new territory, but interesting territory nonetheless in our democracy.
Well, we're still working this out, and I think that Tommy, correct me if I'm wrong, but even the ACLU draws a distinction between a personal account and an official account. And
yeah,
so if this is your official congressman account, mm-hmm. on which you put out how I'm voting and what I'm proposing and the bills I've got sponsored and when my town hall is and all that kind of stuff, that becomes your official platform. And you can't ban people, citizens, voters, constituents, from your official platform. That whole point of that platform is to have a conversation back and forth, and you can't kick people off it, absent, you know, obscenity or threats, which is the way it's supposed to work. You know, the internet wants to be free, and that's the way we play it. But this is new territory for some people, and some public officials. You just take one look at them, and you know they don't know anything about Twitter. They've got an intern doing it for them, but they have to keep up with the times.
All right. Guys, you know, we could probably hash the story out pretty thoroughly, but maybe we'll wait and see where it goes and what happens with politicians who maybe continue to block people. But Tommy, I want to turn, while we have some time still, to another story that you published this week, and this was actually just yesterday, and it has to do with former Representative Jason Chaffetz, our recently former congressman, who has yet another new gig. And we've spoken about his his contract work at Fox News. But this is something a little bit different. What's he
doing?
Yeah,
in fact, he's got several gigs now that he left Congress. I'm sure he's making a pretty penny on some of these. This one I don't think is a paid gig, but they may get a stipend, maybe a housing allowance, too. I'm not sure. But Congressman Chaffetz is actually going to be a fellow at Harvard this fall at the Institute of Politics. They do this every semester, essentially. They bring in a class of people. In Jason's class, for example, there's Karen Finney, who was a Hillary, longtime Hillary person. Dan Balls, who's kind of like the chief, you know, Washington correspondent for the Washington Post. I'm not sure his actual title. And some other people who are like, you know, kind of big names. The guy who runs the Obama Foundation is going to be one of the fellows there. And they work with students. They, you know, can interact with students. They may come in and, you know, have discussions in classrooms. It doesn't mean that Chaffetz is going to be in Cambridge, you know, full time, but he will pop in on occasion and meet with students and hold forums and those kind of things.
It's not a teaching post. It's a sort of it's a fellowship where he drops into classes, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't have to grade papers in this situation.
How long will this fellowship go for?
I think it's just this fall. So I think it begins, you know, when classes start shortly, I guess, and run through the end of the year. Like I said, this is a program they do every semester. They name certain people. And he's kind of a prime pick right now because of, you know, everything topical going on in Washington with President Trump and the Republican Party infighting. He'd be an interesting voice.
George Pyle, I want to just get your opinion here. This is kind of interesting from a guy who stepped down from Congress saying that he wanted to have more, you know, family time, more personal time, essentially. But now we're starting to see him do more and more. And I'm kind of wondering if that points to a different reality that Chaffetz was maybe, I don't know, tired of Washington or or something else.
Well, I mean, you know, this is a New Yorker cartoon cliche. I need to spend more time with my family, or I need to spend more time with my lawyers or something. And yeah, I mean, Congress is an awful lot of work for people who, if you're good at being in Congress, you probably could be good at something else and make a lot more money. And so that's what Jason is doing. And also, it's going to be interesting, you know, you're on Fox News one day, you're at Harvard the next. I mean, that's almost like matter and antimatter. Something's going to be annihilated in that procedure. And if Jason starts saying something like Pak de Ka and Havid Yad, we know that something's changed.
All right. Well, guys, we have kind of extremely limited time here, and I do want to duck actually into the race to replace Jason Chaffetz. The Republican primary is just next week, and there's been a fair amount of money pouring into that race. And Courtney Tanner, this is something that you've been covering. Super PACs, right? I mean, who's been doing the spending? What are they trying to accomplish, and what effect is it having?
Yeah, these super PAC groups, which can spend unlimited amounts of money on candidates on their behalf, they don't donate it to the candidate, have spent $853,000 in this race. It's mostly conservative groups, so Club for Growth, which is in Washington, just a couple groups spending money on ads and attack mailers and that kind of thing.
Okay. And is it giving, you know, is one candidate getting more of the money, and is it having an effect in the, I don't know, the polling?
Provo Mayor John Curtis is getting most of the flack. Former state rep Chris Herod is getting most of the boost from this. It's hard to say what's affected the polling. John Curtis did kind of go down in this most recent poll. It's not clear if that's because of these attack ads or not.
Well, we'll know soon enough on that. And I'm the fact that his lead has dipped a little bit could be from that, you say, but we don't know. The 15th is the day of the election. There are a couple of other elections here, and since we just have Taylor Anderson right here next to me that we should dip into tomorrow. We'll know there's a new Salt Lake County sheriff being selected, also coming up this week as well. Salt Lake County recorder is being replaced.
Right. A lot of elections this week. Don't forget to mail in your ballot or go.
And city
Unless
council.
It's too late. Maybe the deadline's already passed for that. But anyways, the recorder, Gary Ott, is no longer the recorder. We have an acting recorder now. And state law lays out that whatever party an elected official was in, his or her party will decide who is the interim official until the next general election. So we have the recorder's office, formerly held by Republican Gary Ott, and the sheriff's department, which was run by Democrat Jim Winder. Both have left office, and the Democrats will meet tomorrow and pick from numerous candidates who's going to be the interim sheriff, and Republicans will meet next Thursday.
Okay. On the county recorder story, one of the candidates to replace Salt Lake County reporter Gary Ott is his assistant at the office, who's also facing a kind of investigation from the Republican Party with a threat of sanctions of some sort.
Right. And they met last night, and the party, the executive committee met last night and decided they weren't going to do anything ahead of the election. Julie Dole, who's the acting recorder right now, said that that was enough to create, put this cloud over her head. She's under investigation as the Republican Party is heading in to meet and decide whether or not she should remain the recorder, the interim recorder, for the next year and a half. So she's saying that it's creating this aura around her as we head into this election. But there's no findings. They didn't release many details on what they're looking into or why. But there is that investigation ongoing from the party.
Okay. And then just circling back for a moment to the Congressional District 3 race, and maybe this is a question for Courtney, when will we see a ballot after the primary is done? We know that there is a Democratic candidate waiting in the wings. The 15th of August is the Republican primary, and then the election is in November.
So it'll be a little while. You've also got Jim Bennett in the mix, who's running with the new Utah United Party, right, and some other independent candidates.
And George Pyle, an interesting race here in Utah for a special congressional election. I think that the editorial board of Tribune, have you met with all three candidates?
Yeah, we met with all three candidates. We endorsed John Curtis, the mayor of Provo, based just on his experience in government and his seeming level-headedness, at least by the standards of the Republican Party these days. And that was just in the primary. We'll take another look at it come the general, although everybody knows that around here the winner of the Republican primary has pretty much got the skids greased to win in November.
Okay, well, it'll be a different race just next week. It'll be an entirely different race. Guys, we are quickly running out of time, so I want to turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. These are stories that maybe didn't get a lot of light, or that did, and you just want to highlight again, and maybe I'll start with you, Taylor Anderson. What's your pick for underplayed story?
Yeah, well, did I mention there's an election next week? Matt Piper has been covering, if you're in Salt Lake City, he's been covering the city council races, so if you missed those, go find his stories online. He's got the races covered, and go learn about the candidates for that.
And a lot of candidates in some of these races. It's pretty interesting and hard to distinguish between them sometimes as well. Courtney Tanner, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, Aaron Alberty, who does like outdoor columns and reports for the Tribune, wrote about this a youth group who took a group of young women up to Timpanogos Cave, and it was just a beautiful story about these young girls building life skills.
Okay. George Pyle, pick for underplayed story of the week.
Well, this is kind of an interesting one that Kathy Stevenson, who writes about the wonderful world of alcohol for us, they've appointed a new member of the Division of Alcohol Control Board, Thomas Jacobson of Park City. The first question they always ask somebody when they get appointed to this board is, do you drink? Which is often an overly personal question, but in this case we think it's relevant. He won't tell us.
Until after he's confirmed,
which you'd think he would want to know before, if it makes any difference at all. But now we have, we categorize these people by drinkers and, well, social drinkers. Right. You don't just say drinker. I guess that conjures up something else. Social drinkers versus non-drinkers. And it's kind of their version of, Republicans or Democrats or something. And it kind of gets down to, are you regulating a product that you know anything about? And they're kind of moving to the point now where I think that maybe somebody who actually buys this stuff and goes to liquor stores might have something to say.
And it is majority non-drinker right now, I think it is now.
So, again, this is like, an example I've used before. This is like a bunch of vegans regulating butcher shops. Do they know what they're doing?
Part of it, though, would be holding off on saying whether or not you're a drinker to get confirmed, because you might not get confirmed if you announced that you were or weren't. I'm assuming
yes.
that if you were.
If they think it makes any difference, you should tell them.
Okay. George Pyle's pick for underplayed story of the week there. Tommy Burr, what's your pick?
I'm going to go national with this one. I think we've all been worrying about a nuclear war with North Korea. The president's also made some interesting tweets this week about Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. And Trump has really hit McConnell for not passing health care, for not getting some stuff done. Kind of escalates a war with a guy you really need to work with on the Hill. And it's not making the Senate happy. Senator Orrin Hatch was very strong that McConnell's been the best leader we've ever had in his time in the Senate. And again, this is just not a maybe helpful thing. If you actually want to pass some legislation, you kind of need the key guy on the Hill.
Okay, well, and it points to a kind of potential rift between the president and his party as well, Tommy?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the concern, that we're in a situation where the Republicans on the Hill are concerned about what Trump will say about them and do to them, be it, you know, challenge them in some form in an election or just keep hitting them on social media. It's not a good situation.
Okay.
And very rare.
Very, very. It's an interesting one, and we will see what happens in that administration. And also, I'll just do a quick shout out to George Pyle's story on that touches in on the a line from sorry, I can't think of the name of the movie right now. It's Dr. Strangelove.
Dr. Strangelove.
Or How I Learned to Love the Bomb, on the North Korea situation as well. Worth checking out. But for my pick for underplayed story of the week, I have a little bit of an audio clip here to play that goes along with it.
The ramparts we watched.
Okay, I couldn't help myself there. This is a singer at the Summit County Fair on Saturday who has been getting a lot of flack on social media for her performance of the national anthem, which by, I think, almost everybody's account is pretty tough to handle. And she apologized profusely on social media for her performance and said that it was a mistake and she was aiming for something better than it was. And actually, I thought that was pretty bold of her to come forward and say. And so kudos to her, but also check out that story by Kelly Gifford at the Tribune's website, sltrib.com. Well, guys, I want to thank you for being on the show. Courtney Tanner, Thomas Burr, George Pyle, and Taylor Anderson, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us today on Behind the Headlines.
Thank you.
That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW. At Utah Public Radio, the broadcast is managed by Tom Williams, Spencer Holsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen. And many thanks to the show's producer, Emily Means. You can find podcasts of the show at sltrib.com. On Facebook, we are KCPW-FM, and on Twitter, we are at KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great weekend.